Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And I am here today with a legend of the UK magic scene, somebody who has been around for a very, very long time and someone I have a lot of respect for, the one and only Mr. Russ Brown. How you doing, Russ? You okay, mate?
Very good. That's a good intro.
Well, you are. You're a legend. I mean, you are. And I want to get into, in this interview, why you're a legend and everything that you've done. But I mean, I've known you for a very long time, and what you've done in magic in your career, most people wish they'd only done 10% of that. I mean, it's just crazy everything that you've achieved. And I know you're really busy, so thanks for finding time for coming on the channel. I really appreciate it. Now, I'm going to say up front, a lot of this video is going out, obviously, before the Blackpool convention. Obviously, you guys are doing a virtual Blackpool convention, yep, which I'm really interested to talk about. But I want to get to that a little bit later on. First of all, I want to find out more about you. And more importantly, for anybody who doesn't know who Russ Brown is, I want to kind of let everyone know who you are, because, you know, I've openly said this on the channel. I think you're absolutely brilliant. I actually said this to your face the last time I saw your lecture. Your lecture is one of the best lectures I've ever seen. It's incredible. So I want to talk more about you, if that's okay, first of all. So let's start at the very beginning, Russ. Let's start. How did you get into magic? When was it?
Very beginning, yeah, was probably the same as everyone else. Do you know what? I'm doing this in my magic room, and I'm just going to go behind me and have a look and see if I've still got where it all started. I will have somewhere. Oh, there we go. It's falling apart now. But that's where it all started. It's falling apart. Will Dexter book. Wow. So, still got it. Round at my grandma's house. My cousin gave me that. I was 5 years old. And that was it. I was hooked. I wanted to be a magician. As soon as I read that book, I learned every trick in the book, as you could say. I went round my mum's house, literally pulling down curtains. I can remember once, because that book had a rope trick in it, I pulled down a pair of curtains because I saw the top bit had a bit of rope running through it. So I pulled down the curtains to get the rope so that I could do the trick. And at that point, I lived in Bradford with my mum and dad and my brother. And it's the same as everybody else. After the bug hit me, and all I wanted to do was magic. All I was interested in was magic. I wanted to. Every birthday was magic books. Every birthday, every Christmas was magic tricks. That's all I wanted. In fact, this is a good story. I'll tell you how old I was, because the letter's there. I'll show you that in a sec. 7 years old. I'd been doing magic now for 2 years. 2 years. So I was an expert at seven. And every Saturday, like everybody else, I used to watch Paul Daniels. And my favourite trick was the dancing pencil. So I used to get a piece of cotton, put it on and do the dancing pencil. And I wrote to Paul Daniels because I'd never seen him do it. At 7 years old, I wrote a letter to him and I said, "Dear Paul, I've been watching your show for 2 years and I do magic myself. I don't know how I had the nerve. And I've never seen you do this trick. So I'm just checking if you know it, just in case you know it. If you don't know it," I wrote out all the instructions and I said, "This is how to do it. And I think it'd look great on your show." And at 7 years old, and this is up here, I got that back, which is a letter from Paul Daniels at 7 years old, all embossed up here. He did know the trick, funnily enough. Not only did he know the trick on this letter, it tells me the history of the trick as well. But finishes it up, good luck with the magic, keep practicing. 7 years old, I mean, that was huge, really. You know, it couldn't have been any bigger. That's like, for people nowadays, that is the equivalent of Blaine, of Copperfield, of Dynamo writing to you. So that was that. I just kept going from there.
And it just shows what a nice guy Paul Daniels was as well. Mm. It just shows that, you know, a lot of people would have just taken that letter and chucked it in the bin.
Yeah. I think I was 8 years old, a year after that, when my mum and dad moved from Bradford to Blackpool. And when they moved to Blackpool, funnily enough, he did the summer season, did Daniels. And my mum and dad saved up, got me some tickets. We went to see it. And they'd told him about the letter and said, you know, you wrote in this letter and all this. And then he found out where we were sitting. He got me up on stage to do the Lincoln Rings with him. And then sent somebody out and said, come and meet me backstage afterwards. And we went and sat backstage with him for 10 minutes. And, you know, that was massive. It was massive. It was huge.
How awesome is that? I mean, wow, that's incredible. So did you, obviously, so the bug bit at a very young age, you know, you were obsessed with magic. I don't even know the answer to this. Russ, did you ever have a proper job or did you go straight from education into being a performer?
Never had a proper job. I finished, as I was going through school, I was constantly, what do you want to do? And the careers officer, told me I'd make a very good warehouse manager. Brilliant. So anyway, we went through school. Obviously, throughout school, I kept saying, I want to do magic professionally. I want to be a professional magician, et cetera, et cetera. So that was that. And then when I was 16, I left school and two things happened at once, which were both very cool. The first one was, people may remember this, in the Winter Gardens, where the Olympia is, which we don't really use at the convention because it's a barn of an area, but we are considering using it for something. In 2022, we've come up with an idea on it. It's got no atmosphere because it's so big. That used to be a thing called Peabody's. And Peabody's was a huge adventure playground. It had a slide called the Monster Drop, a vertical slide and things like that. It was brilliant. So I used to go in there as a kid. And when I was 16, I don't believe I had the nerve to do this. At 16, I phoned up the Winter Gardens, found out who the manager was, not of the Peabody's, of the entire Winter Gardens, a woman called Mel. I booked an appointment to see her. I had no idea what I was going to do. I turned up wearing a dinner suit with a bow tie because that's what I wore on stage. I had my case full of stuff. I walked into her office, stood in her office, did a show for 10 minutes, and then said, you need a magician in Peabody's. And she was like, no, we don't. And I said, you do. I said, I used to go in as a kid. And it was, you know, you need a break from going on the slides and going on the bouncy castles. You need half an hour to sit down. And if you have a magic show, it'll work. So at first she said no. So then I made a deal with her that I said, for 1 week, I'll appear there for free. I'm allowed to sell balloons afterwards, so I'll make something. And at the end of the week, if it works, you give me a job. So she was like, yeah, that's fine. She had nothing to lose. And throughout the week, I went to Bill Thompson, who made me about 20 big posters, which I put up all around the Winter Gardens and town without permission, saying that I was appearing there for 1 week only. Bill was a brilliant help with stuff like that. After that, I was doing like two shows a day in there. And then on the final day, she come in and she said, well, you know, it's sort of worked and there is a bit of interest and all this, and maybe we could do something. And just as she was saying that, a woman come up with a kid. It couldn't have even been cued better. And she went, have you done your magic show? And I went, yeah, you've missed it today. And she went, oh. And she went, we'll come back tomorrow then. And she didn't go in because she were coming for the show. And then that were it. That sealed it. So then I worked there for probably about 6 years after that. I got that job. And then on a night, I used to work on Mystique.
Well, Mystique, legendary in Blackpool. You know what I mean?
That's where I learned everything. I mean, I did go to drama college, but I learned everything at Mystique and Peabody's, everything. And Mystique, you know, that was so cool.
You met Russ Stevens as well.
Yeah, that's where I knew Russ from going into Bill Thompson's shop and going to watch the Mystique show when I were about 15. And I was 16. This is a bizarre story. It was the opening night and Russ had got a magician appearing in the show and, you know, a few other bits. And Russ come running out. It was opening night. And he went, he said, you know those tricks you do in Bill's? He went, are they normal cards? Can you do them normally? And I went, yeah. And he went, we've booked a close-up magician to do the tables tonight with it being opening night. And he turned up and he's terrible. He said, he's terrible. We can't put him out there. And I you were to be suited up to go in Mystique then. And he said, can you just do the tables and we'll sort something out? So I went, yeah. So I jumped out of my seat and went and did all the tables, went backstage and chatted. And then straight after that, they then offered me to keep doing close-up in there and pitch Svengalis and stuff like that, which I used to do. And then at the same time as that, they decided to train me up as the swing backstage in case anybody was ill. And then about 3 weeks into the season, somebody backstage left. So I ended up working on Peabody's in the day. I used to literally get up, do Peabody's, finish Peabody's, go back to mum and dad at a fish and chip shop, go back, have some fish and chips, get me suit on, get on the bus, go and do Mystique.
So you're basically just immersed in magic almost 24/7.
Yeah.
And what a great experience. You're learning on the job. Right. That's incredible. Now, I want to ask you something about that whole thing, because back in those days, when I was younger and you were younger, and a lot of newer magicians don't even get this, close-up magic wasn't as big a deal as it is now. Like, I remember when I was a kid, it wasn't like, oh, I want this new pack of cards. I was like, I want this chair suspension. I want this, yeah. That. That was what it was all about. Everybody was kind of like, I want to be a stage magician. Yeah. Now, you just talked about doing close-up. Back in the day, when you at 16, when you first started doing Peabody's, because you're known as a family entertainer and a stage magician now, did you have, I mean, what type of magician did you want to be? Because you mentioned close-up, but...
Do you know what? I was absolutely into everything. I was into everything. I learned close-up, and close-up-wise, you know, a lot of magicians, when they get chatting to me and I start doing stuff, they're quite surprised at what I can do. They're quite surprised, you know, I do stuff like the Reformation and things like that, you know, quite knuckle-busting stuff. And I still learn a lot of knuckle-busting stuff because I quite enjoy it, just being able to do it. So close-up-wise, when I was about 14... I think the first book that I got into was the Gary Kurtz book, The Unexplained Act. I got it out of the Magicians Club library, out of Blackpool Library. I learned a lot from that, then a lot from the Chris Kenner book, From Out of Control. And I learned a lot of, now, which at 14, 15, I didn't realise I were learning quite heavy moves from the start. And I used to go in Bill Thompson's a lot, and Bill would be brilliant in the fact that I'd go in and he'd sit and teach me a move, and I'd spend, you know, weeks in there learning one move. So I got into everything. At first I did want to be, I've just hit the thing on my chair. down. At first I did want to be a stage magician at first, really, because close-up wasn't a big thing then. But I learned that, I learned close-up, I learned the kids' entertainment, which I really enjoyed doing anyway. I got into illusions, so from working with Russ. So in the end, I just learned every aspect of magic. I just got into everything. Yeah, any it always stuns me that at the convention, me and Russ have had this chat. I've spoke to some pretty well-known, I mean, really well-known magicians, really well-known, we've said to them, what do you think to the gala show? Don't watch the gala show, we're only interested in close-up. And it just stuns me, because if it's magic, I'll watch anything. I will watch anything, because I think that's how you learn. You learn from learning every single aspect of the art. So
I completely agree. I think the best close-up magicians are the ones that have got a background in stage magic, because you see those close-up magicians that go and do like banquet tables and they perform for like two people. You can also have guys that have worked on stage. They treat it like a mini cabaret show.
Yeah.
You know, which is totally important. So this is really fascinating. So you've got some serious chops as a close-up magician. You're doing close-up at Mystique, and you're also working in the show. You're working really closely with Russ Stevens. You're also working at Peabody's, which is obviously developing you as a family entertainer. And by the way, like I said at the very beginning of this interview, your lecture on family entertainment is brilliant, because you aren't a typical kids entertainer. The stuff that you do for kids works just as well for adults. And let's talk about that for a minute, actually, because I think that's something that anybody who's interested in performing for kids, I remember you saying in lecture, you aim it at the adults. They're the ones that are going to be booking the parties, and everything that you do, it's almost like a cabaret show, even though it's a kids show. It's not. Do you know what I mean?
It's that all come from when I finished working at Peabody's. I did a season at the Pleasure Beach as family entertainer there in a place called the Sheriff's Bar. And at that point, Russ had left Mystique. Richard DeVere had took over Mystique. And I just didn't get on with Richard. They offered it. I did one season with Richard. And, you know, it wasn't for me. Me and Richard, he just wasn't my kind of magician. He wasn't into it like I was. I found it a bit annoying that, you know, he'd just buy a trick to just do... You know, just throw away, really. Whereas I were really into it. So I didn't really get on with Richard. So that all come from, I did the Pleasure Beach for a season as kids entertainer. But all the time that I was at Peabody's and the Pleasure Beach, Blackpool Tower approached me nearly every year to work as the resident magician there, along with Harvey Seeger. And it never worked out simply because I were doing Peabody's, I were doing Mystique or the Pleasure Beach or... The money of the Peabody's and Mystique was really good, especially at that age. It was really good. So because of that, it wasn't worth me quitting them just to do the Tower, because I'd have to quit just to do that. So anyway, I decided after the Pleasure Beach, they got rid of the bar that we were in. I thought, I'm going to go to the Tower. And that was a real shock, because the Tower... Well, at that point, I was a typical kids entertainer. I used to do, you know, I've still got them up here somewhere, over there. I used to do Hippie Hoppy Rabbits and Die Box and, you know, there's standard stuff. I did the Tower. I followed Harvey Seeger. It was awesome. He'd done 21 years there. He knew I'd play that room perfectly. And the room was a big bar. It had about 500 people in there. And it was always rammed. It was never quiet. It was always packed to capacity. But the problem in there was this. You were doing a show. However, 10 paces that way was Europe's biggest adventure playground, which was free and included. So if you were boring, the kids would just get up and they would walk off. They'd go. That way, you went up Blackpool Tower. So you went to go up Blackpool Tower and stand on a glass floor. So if that were boring, they'd walk off that way. That way, you had the circus, you had the aquarium. So what I'm trying to say is you had to hold everybody's attention. If the kids got bored, they'd go get the adults and they'd walk off. If the adults got bored, they'd go get the kids, because there was always something better to do in Blackpool Tower than watch my show if it wasn't good enough. So I very quickly over that season realised that it had to be more like you just said, like a mini cabaret, that, you know, it had to work on two levels. You had to have that speed and that excitement to keep the kids interested, but also real rapid fire. My show's very fast, rapid fire gags at the adults to keep the adults interested. So that I ended up staying at the Tower for 12 years as a resident magician and still do stuff at the Tower. They, you know, I only left because they got rid of the room that we were performing in, and now they've got a room back in there and I still do stuff at the Tower. So the Tower was quite...
Your name was synonymous with the Tower for a very, very long time.
Oh, I used to... I really enjoyed the Tower. I ended up, after about 5 years of being there, I felt like I'd really made that room my own. It was like, you know, it was like the big... I had full control of anything I wanted to do in there, which, you know, they used to let me rig the room up. We used to have signs on the stage advertising. I mean, one of the signs is up here, advertising what time the shows were. And the Tower let me put things into the stage. So those signs were actually a levitation. So everything was out all day. The kids were like literally sitting on the signs, messing with the clocks on it and things like that. Little did they know it had all the bars in for a levitation. And, you know, we used to have curtains up at the back that used to look like I'd pulled things down. So it looked a miracle. You know, I'd just suddenly get two signs, put the two signs together, get a piece of curtain that I'd pulled down from the back cloth, lay a kid on it and levitate him. It was great.
That's awesome. So what advice would you give somebody that's watching this that wants to become a family entertainer and they want to put an act together that's relevant? Is there any advice you can give?
You know what advice I'd say? When I perform, when I work, I dress... And I always have had for children's entertainment and family entertainment. I've dressed in a suit. I've dressed really smart. So waistcoat, and, you know, I don't wear a tie because I've got no neck and it doesn't suit me. I look like that with a tie. But I've always dressed very, very, very smart. And there's a reason why. I think that you command a bit more respect from the adults if you're not dressed like a buffoon and chef's trousers, number one. Number two, I think when you're on, when you come out and you're smartly dressed and you start being silly and you start doing funny stuff, it's out of context to the kids. It makes it funnier. It makes it better. Then if you're dressed as a clown, you're dressed like an idiot and you're acting like an idiot, you're an idiot. It's to be expected. But if you're dressed like, I don't know, a solicitor, and you're really smart, and then you start acting like an idiot, it's a bit out of context and it makes it funnier. So, but what I would say is, it don't work for everybody. I think a lot of people, and I've seen a lot of kids, I've seen some really good kids entertainers who stood there and gone, you mustn't do this, and this is how you must dress. And that's not the answer. Everybody's different. You've only got to watch the Family Entertainer comp. I've had people walk onto that comp who, you know, I've looked at them and I've thought, and seen them in tech call and thought, my God, this isn't going to work. They're going to be dreadful. And, you know, we'll see how they do. And it's going to be silence. And they rip the place apart. You know, you just don't know. You've got to find what works for you, not copy anybody else, not go off what everybody else says. This is what you must do. It's everything. Everybody's different. It all works different for everyone.
That's amazing advice. It really is. So you're now, you've been working at the Tower for quite a while. You know, your name is synonymous with magic when it comes to Blackpool. Like, you are Mr. Magic in Blackpool. Now, you run a company that supplies acts and entertainment literally all over the world. How did you get from working at the Tower as like a one-man band entertainer to, you know, recruiting and supplying entertainment worldwide?
There's a few things happened, really. The Tower started to get to a point that they would be coming to me saying, we need this tonight. Do you know anyone? And I'd go, yeah. And it ended up, you know, to the point that we were putting stuff in the ballroom of the Tower, which is a beast of a room to work. It's like really hard. We're putting stuff in the ballroom every night throughout the summer. And I was doing everything. I was literally booking the acts, arranging everything. And then after a while, I thought, why am I doing this and not being setting up as an agent? This is stupid. So I set up as an agent, which I had a lot of friends all booking in it. So then I didn't run it very well because if they were my friend, I'd felt bad charging them commissions and they'd charge them things. So we run it as an agent for a bit. And then from there, it got that other companies like, I run these Christmas party nights at Preston, which I've done for a long time. They approached me, they saw what I could do and say, can you put us something in here? The worldwide stuff was quite a mental story, really. We had, I don't know if you all know him, but there's a guy called Geir Lundberg, who's a brilliant kids entertainer, brilliant, from Sweden. And I worked with Geir on FISM, which was insane. We stage managed, I think we stage managed nearly 200 acts. If anybody says, what's your lasting memory of FISM? One of my memories was that at one point I went out to get a coffee with Steve Evans. Steve come and see me and said, just have a break, come and have a coffee. And I walked outside and I swear to God, I couldn't see. I had been backstage that long for that many days. I walked outside and I couldn't see my eyes. I was just like this, my eyes, I couldn't see anything. So it was crazy. Anyway, I stage managed FISM with Gay. We joined, did it. And we had great fun and I got on very well with Gay. And Gay stayed a few more days. And at that point, I'd moved from the Tower into a little venue called Planet Rock at the Pleasure Beach, which was an on-park show, which I did for Amanda for about 5 years. And we had UV shows in there. And my UV shows, much like my normal stuff, to give you an idea, this is how I used to write the UV shows. I used to write them with Tony Stevens. I'm still, you know, Tony's still involved with stuff. If anybody remembers Tony from the British Magical Championships, he was brilliant. And the way we used to write it is, I decided, much like Python, we didn't need a story. We didn't need a punchline. No one had done a UV show like this. We just needed gags. It just needed to be rapid fire because I hated on UV shows that it seems to be a puppet comes up, it sings for literally 3 minutes and then it goes down, then the next one, 3 minutes. So I wanted it to be rapid fire, and I wanted it to be stupid, absolutely mayhem, stupid. So that's what I did, and I come up with one that we did at the Tower for a long time, and then we moved to the Pleasure Beach, and that were a big attraction at the Pleasure Beach. So Gay said, I want to come in and, you know, see the show at the Pleasure Beach. So he watched the UV show. Then afterwards, he said, I've worked with these ships in Sweden, and they would love it. It would, because there's no language barrier. It's very visual. They've never had anything quite like it. So they'd love it. So it was a bit of a whirlwind, really. Straight after that, he said, I'm going to get them to come over and watch. So they come over to watch with a view to put it on two of the ships that were out there, the two flagships. They've got seven ships. So they watched it and they were like, it's brilliant. We love it. We've never had anything like it. It's the most bizarre product we've ever put on, but we'll have it. Then it was literally, can you fly to Sweden in 2 days? We want to show you the ships. So we're like, yeah. So I moved everything out there. Flew to Sweden, met them. Well, Trek, unbelievably well. They're such a good company. So nice to work for. I went out to Sweden and they wanted to show me all their ships, not just two, all of them. So me being me on every ship, we're going, oh, it'd work on here. Oh, it'd be great in there. It'd be great. So then at the end, they went, can you put it on all seven ships? So I went, yeah. So that was that. And then I got the contract. I'm like, oh my God, this is a massive task. Massive. I had to find 14 staff. I nearly had to mortgage the house for how much it costs. People, especially the people who work for me sometimes, don't understand the huge amount of investment you have to put into a project like that. Huge. So that was that. I bought seven sets of UV shows, 14 huge flight cases, seven sets of magic shows as well, and did the contract. And this said, you know, on the first year, I just about broke even because it cost me so much to put it together. And then they just said to me, you know, you're probably, we only book things for 2 years. That's it. And then we change. So, you know, it's not, we're not being, that we don't want yet, but we only book things for 2 years. So they booked it a second year. And then the third year, they said, oh, well, we're going to look at other things. And they come back. What would you do if you could do something? So I showed them what I'd come up with. Yeah, we'll book it a third year. Then they booked it a fourth year. So, and this will be, this year, if it goes ahead, hopefully, will be the fifth year that we've done with them. So, and I love it. I absolutely, I love that thing of the training, of doing it, of getting 14 people in this room and teaching them the UV shows. I might, I'll send you some pictures and some video footage of the training, just so you can see the level of what we did. It's insane.
That is amazing. And if somebody's watching this and they want to work with you, because I know you've taken people that are newer into magic and you've literally taught them everything that you know and then sent them off on ships for like, and they're just loving it. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever. How would people get on your radar, Russ?
Just drop me an email. Just drop me an email, russ@russbrownmagic.com. That's it. Just drop me an email. I mean, the people that we've had doing this, most of them have returned year after year after year. The ships have wanted them back and they've wanted to come back. So, you know, there's only been a couple that we've lost. One of the things that I discovered about this was it's a lot easier to teach an actor than it is a magician. An actor will listen to you more than a magician will. But they've nearly all come back. This year, though, we've lost, if it does go ahead, we've lost a few because of the pandemic. So many people that I know that are actors and magicians that have phoned up and they've gone, well, you know, I've got a normal job now. And it breaks my heart a little bit because especially there's one of them who he'd only just started. I was his first professional job. And I watched this lad grow in confidence and everything. And I spoke to him and he said, well, I've got a normal job. And I'm like, oh, that's a shame because he was so good.
I've seen so many magicians that have decided to call it a day, not just
yeah, so many
people that I was speaking to, your friend and my friend Alec Powell the other day. He just rang me up out of the blue and he was just saying, I've got all of my friends are dropping like flies. Like, it's, you know, people that have been doing it for years and years and years have decided to call it a day, which is a shame. But, you know, when things get back to normal, you know, there's going to be a lot of opportunity. Yeah.
I did last year with the pandemic and everything. I did, for the first time in my life, a normal job For about 3 months, and it was brilliant. The woman who owns Blackpool Pleasure Beach, Amanda Thompson, who I can honestly not praise enough. I cannot praise that woman enough. She's done a lot for me over the years, hell of a lot. And she emailed me and just asked how I was. And I said, you know, all my work's gone. I'm a bit down and not qualifying for work things and all this. And she just said, do you want a job on the park? She said, you know the park. You live so close to it. What do you want to do? And I went, well, I know the park backwards. I could do, like, I don't know, on information or something. And she literally went, okay. And then an hour later, I got a call. Can you come for an interview? And the guy did the interview, and he actually asked two questions and then went, listen, can you just fill in the form? Because basically, you could punch me in the face and I have to give you the job. So that was that. So I did that. I did this ambassador job, which I really enjoyed doing, actually. I enjoyed the lack of pressure. There were no pressure. So I did that for a few months. And then in October, live shows were allowed to go ahead with restrictions, with social distancing. And she called me in the office and she went, right, we can put a show on. Do you want the Horseshoe, where we used to do Mystique? And she said, you can do what you want in there. So I did a couple of weeks, me and Steve Royal put a show together. So that was that.
And obviously this is coming out, this interview is going to go out very soon after we film it, because we want to talk about the virtual convention. So, you know, I know a lot of magicians are down in the dumps at the moment, but in the UK at any rate, I know that you and I were talking off camera beforehand. You and I are both seeing people are getting, yeah. You said that your December is looking really good.
Yeah, my December's packed. My December, I can't literally have another gig in December now. It's rammed. October's good. September's all right. But the ones up to that, like August and June, when it's normally very, very busy, they're a bit more hesitant. People are a bit more hesitant. Although I've just had another theme park at Southport that I've worked at quite a lot. And they've just contacted me saying that they think that they might want shows back in the summer. So,
obviously, as you know, I've got the contract with my company with Drayton Manor.
Yeah.
And they just rung up and said they want all the entertainment back as of like a couple of weeks' time. And, you know, we've taken about 5 or 6 bookings for the Illusion show in the last week as well. So I'm just saying this so that people watch this and know there is light at the end of the tunnel. It's not just going to be tunnel forever.
Yeah. You know, it has been depressing, but I think it is coming back. And I think, you know, it's going to take some time, but I think it'll build back up again. I think Absolutely. It will.
No, I completely agree. So let me ask you a question. Actually, before I ask you this question, let me ask you one more thing. What advice, because you've been phenomenally successful your whole career. Like, you literally, like you said, went straight from school, straight into full-time entertainment, and that's what you've done your entire life. Have you got any advice for somebody who's wanting to be a full-time magician? Let's just assume that everything does go back to normal, the pandemic goes away. Do you have any advice for somebody who wants to be a full-time magician?
My advice would be persistence, which is Ray Kroc's thing, isn't it, from McDonald's? But it's true. Persistence works. Persistence, you know, you've just got to keep going and keep going and keep going at people until it's easier for them to say yes than it is to say no, is one thing. And my other advice, which sounds a stupid one, is be good at what you do. Somebody once on the ships thing who was working for me, who was a magician, who was very good as well, he said to me, what would you say? He said, you're always working. He said, you're always busy. And he said, what would you say? What's your advertising and all this? And I can honestly say, I've hardly ever advertised, hardly ever, never really, because everything that I've got is through word of mouth, everything. And it's because I'd finish a show and then people would then, you know, want to book me for something else. I didn't really want to go down the Zoom route, but over Christmas I did some Zoom shows that I were only doing 5 minutes in this one thing that I got talked into, which then led to the people who'd seen 5 minutes then contacted me and saying, can you do an hour? Can you do this? And, you know, I think that's the thing. Learn your craft. Like, I think with magic now, a lot of people, when I said before about the fact that I learned about every aspect of magic, every single anything, it interests me, whatever it is, mentalism, anything. If it's magic, I'll learn about it. And I think that's something that people don't really do anymore. They just go on YouTube. And I think learn your craft is a massive piece of advice.
really true. You know, you mentioned Steve Evans before. He was a big influence on my career.
Yeah, I love Steve.
I used to catch the bus over to his house every couple of weeks, and he'd just have me there performing for him, and just he'd be ripping my act apart.
Every yeah, he did.
Go back and work on that.
Let me have a look in here. Honestly, it's colder in it in here actually. There we go. These were that and that. When Steve found out we were dying, he come round to my house. He phoned me up, and he said, "I need to come round and have something to eat." And I went, "Oh, okay." So me and Debbie were like, "All right, it'd be nice to see you in September." And he went, "No, I really need to talk to you, and it's quite serious." So we're like, "Oh." And he's just come in and told me, you know, I've got a few months to live, and that's that. And we were like, "Oh my God." And then he said, "I'm going to give you two things. I'm going to give you my City of Wolverhampton badge," which for no reason he decided he wanted to give me that. And he said, "I'm going to give you this." And he said, "Because this you're meant to put on your keyboard and it cleans your keyboard. But I've discovered if you do this inside it, it can make a fart sound." And he said, "As soon as I realised it could do that, I thought of nobody better to give it to than you." So that was that. And Steve, I can remember when he did that, it was about a month, maybe 2 months before the convention. So I was like, he said, "One of my things is I want to do something backstage at the Blackpool Convention." He had a list, he had a bucket list. So I said, "Oh, okay." And I said, "Do you know what?" I said, "I'll put you on the kids' comp. And I'll put you on sound." Said, "I'll put you on the microphones." And it's very fast moving. It's very complex because we have about 6 mics and we have to swap it between each one. And so I said, "I'll put you on that." Said, "You can do that." So the lad who did the mics was called Keith. And he come up to me. "Who's this fella?" I said, "Yeah, that's my job." And I went, "No, no." I said, "Listen." I said, "He's really poorly. Really." I said, "He's got months to live." I said, "So, and it's one of his things. He wants to do it." Oh, God, oh, sorry, I didn't realise. Sorry. Right, okay. So we let him do it. Anyway, the year after, Steve was still going. It was like a miracle. He was still going. Yeah. Andy said, "Can I do it again?" So this kid saw him and he went, "What?" And he went, "Oh, I'm pleased that he's still going and all this." The year after, he was still going. I can remember he walked in and Keith looked at him and went, "Oh, come on, he's just taking the piss now, mate. What's going on?" You know, Steve, he thought he was brilliant. He loved it. And then Steve, when he eventually died, Steve, his funeral, did you go to Steve's funeral?
Yeah.
You may remember, or you may not remember this one little bit. One of his wishes in his will was that Russ Stevens's Shape of My Heart routine was his favourite routine in magic. His favourite routine. And by the way, the last time that routine was ever performed was at my 40th birthday. Russ did it at my 40th. Wow. And that's the last time Russ performed. So he put in his will that he wanted Russ to perform the card routine. But because I used to work with Russ in Mystique, there's a bit where he does the card sword, and I used to walk on and hand him the sword. And Steve remembered that. And the other part of the will was that I had to be the swordsman. I had to be the person doing that. And it was the most bizarre, emotional thing we've done. Me and Russ felt very, you know, we sat backstage before doing it and we were both so nervous and felt very weird about it. Then on the way back, we're just chatting about Steve all the way home. It was a funny thing.
He really was a legend.
Yeah, and he
used to say to me, I remember him every time, he used to say to me, "Be so good that they can't ignore you."
Yeah, that's brilliant advice. What we were just saying, same thing.
Yeah, be so good that they can't ignore you. Completely agree. Now, before we start talking about the convention, I have got one other thing to talk about, because a lot of people don't think of you as a creator of magic, but you have created some amazing stuff throughout the years that people might not be aware of because you don't shout it from the rooftops. And one of the routines that you have created, I have been trying to buy this bloody thing ever since I saw it, and both you and Guy never seem to have it available, which is the bowling ball routine, where it's the most logical way of doing a watch smash ever.
Okay.
For those people that don't know it, this is such an amazing routine. It's a full stage routine. It's a watch smash, but you've got a bowling ball production in there, and you put the bowling ball down, and then behind your back, and you're not even aware, the bowling ball just rolls off and just smashes the watch, which is the whole routine is brilliant. And you, I have offered so much money to so many different people to buy that bloody thing, and no one seems to have it. Where did that come about? And obviously also in with that, we have to bring up Guy Barrett, who
yeah.
is an amazing illusion builder. He's responsible for my entire illusion show. When did you and Guy kind of come together?
Well, funnily enough, I'll tell you about the watch routine first, and I'll tell you about Guy. When I was working at the Pleasure Beach, I ended up doing a show, which you can see just behind me there. There's the poster for the show, Carnival yeah. Magic. And it was a magic show based on a carnival. And I had that idea in my head well before I did it. And when I was doing Planet Rock, the show at the Pleasure Beach that you could walk into if you were on park, I had the idea, and it's a bizarre thing, this, and it sounds stupid, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was laid in bed, I couldn't sleep, and I had this idea of doing a sideshow, one of the sideshow games, which were going to be the throwing the darts at the balloons to mix with the old balloon tray thing of Jack Hughes. So I had that idea and the whole idea of having the bowling ball roll off something, hit something to smash a watch like Mousetrap. And I had that idea. And then the final idea was that it were going to be that they had to pop the balloons to win the prize. The prize were going to be the watch. I'd done the bowling ball like 20 minutes earlier in the show. It was completely irrelevant to the trick. It's just sat there, so you forgot about it. So the prize were going to be the punter's watch if you popped all three balloons. So that was the gag. And then we did the balloon tray thing so that the sideshow stand would fall apart. The curtains would fall off it. Letters would fall off it. The balloons would go down. They'd fly off. And then eventually I get to a point that I go, God, is anything else going to go wrong? And at that point, the ball hits the watch and smashes the watch. And then the final balloon gets popped and the watch is tied up inside the balloon on a ribbon. And then the original idea was to then say, but that's not your prize. Pull up a sheet, drop it and say, that's your prize. And there's a dodging car on the stage, right?
I remember being at Guy's warehouse when he had a Dodgem car there.
Yeah.
Well, like, what the hell is this? He said, I can't tell you, but it's for Russ Brown. I'm like, yeah. Why am
I? That was the original idea. And then I realized, chatting to Guy and chatting to Tony, that it were two different tricks, that the Dodgem was too good to just throw away as a kicker. So that made me come up with a sideshow smash routine. For some reason, the entire thing popped in my head, 2 o'clock in the morning, couldn't sleep, and I genuinely got out of bed. My wife was like, what's wrong? And I went, I've had an idea. And I went and wrote it all down. And then sat with Guy, found out, you know, the bits and pieces like the balloon tray, whether that I needed to buy the rights. I found out it's a public domain thing now, and things like that, and built up the routine from there. But there's quite a few things I've come up with over the years. I went through a stage of, and I'm still a little bit like that, and it sounds a strange thing, this, that if I did a trick that I just bought, I felt like everybody watched it and thought, that's not his. So everything I did, I used to invent. I've invented quite a lot of stuff, really, over the years. And quite a lot of it I've just kept to myself.
You don't market a lot of it, do you?
I don't push it. Some of it you can get, but I don't push it, simply because I'd rather have that only a few people did it than everybody doing it. And, you know, there's my thing, which is a bit stupid, really. I'd be better off with the money, but... It's just how I am with it.
I totally understand that.
Guy, we have a lot. This is another thing that I couldn't find in here. I've got my trophies up here. lots and lots and lots of them. So there's one of them that was 1986 when I won the Blackpool Magicians Club Junior Magician. There's quite a few Junior Magician ones up there. And me and Guy used to be rivals. We were rivals. Guy used to enter every competition and win it with his, you know, he had a great act with his bloody bim bam box and all this stuff, Guy Barrett and Pamela. It was great. And then I come along on a competition and it were going to be his hat trick. In fact, I mentioned this the other week and went, you still can't let it die, can you? It had been 3 years in a run that he'd won this competition and I won it. And then I beat him in something else and something else. Then Guy had beat me in something. And we did end up a little bit like rivals. It was a bizarre thing. And we grew up like that and, you know, and just stayed friends. You know, me, Russ and Guy are literally all best friends. And, you know, it's a funny situation.
That's fantastic. And which brings us to the Blackpool Magic Convention, because outside of all of the stuff that you do and outside of all the companies that you run and all the craziness that you have going on in your life, and, you know, you also have been involved with the Blackpool Magic Convention, which you do for the love of it.
Literally.
Yeah. And you know, it's I know how hard you work at that, and you've been doing that for a very long time now. How did you get involved in the Blackpool Convention?
I got involved in the Blackpool Club originally from Cyril Critchlow. I was about, I think I was nine, and I found Cyril's shop, which is kitchen. And I went in and bought a couple of standard Paul Daniels tricks and stuff. And then Cyril like realized and said, you're pretty into this. And, you know, I think you've got a natural talent for it. So then he sort of took me under his wing and started selling me better things. There's a few things from Cyril's, the multiplied bottles of Cyril's, the boomerangs there. There's a Davenport's lecture poem picture. A lot of the stuff on there is stuff that I bought from Cyril's when I was young. And he got me into Blackpool Magic Club. Officially, you had to be 16 to be in the club. And they had a junior section, which got disbanded when I was 12. And then they decided to let me in anyway. But from nine, I was a runner at the Blackpool Magic Convention at 9 years old. Could you imagine? I used to have jobs at 9 years old, like they would just suddenly say to me, can you take this to Johnny Hart? And I'd be like, and that is what I always used to do. I always used to get their autographs. Johnny Hart's will be in there. Paul Daniels is in there. Kavari, Daryl, Ali Bongo, Jonathan Pendragon. So when I was younger, I used to have this job as a runner at the Blackpool Convention. Murray. I had a job at the Blackpool Convention as this runner, going round and, you know, taking stuff to what were the stars, really, the big names in magic. And that was it. It was so exciting. So I kept doing that for years. I'm trying to see who else I've got in here now. I've had a look. So Harry Blackstone's in there.
Wow.
Obviously Doddy. There's Blackstone's there. So that was the Paul Daniels. That was the card he sent me with the letter when I was seven. But yes, I used to do that. And then when I were about 15, well, about 16, actually, because I was working backstage on Mystique, Bill Lamb and Guy, who was backstage then, decided to put me on backstage with them. So then I did backstage for a lot of years. And then after a few years of that, Guy was so busy with his illusion stuff, he stepped away from the convention. He just didn't have the time to do anything. Because, I mean, even just stage managing takes up a good 6 months of your life, yeah, easily. Yeah. So he stepped away and I took over stage managing, which I stage managed for a long, 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 long time, still do. And then when Derek stepped away, which he did, that's not what everybody thinks with Derek when he went.
That's, you know, if you want to put that to bed now, you can do
it. Yeah, I can tell you about that if you wish. So when Derek stepped away, the club sort of said to me, do you want to start running it? And I said, yes, with Russ, with Guy as well. It's not a one-person job, this. It's a few of us, and we all work together, and, you know, it's great. Derek, if you want me to tell you just quick, because this is the most asked question I get. In the last years of the convention that Derek did, I'm not exaggerating when I say that Derek used to finish the convention. I mean, he is. The stress of the convention is unreal. I mean, it is absolutely unreal to run that. The stress is through the roof. It's very, very hard. And that's with three of us, when we're one person doing it. So Derek was finishing the convention and then literally sometime, one time he ended up in hospital just from, he was just exhausted. He was just physically and mentally, you know, he was in his 80s. He was physically and mentally exhausted at the end of this. So the committee had already contacted me, Russ and Guy, and said, would you work with Derek on the convention with a view to, in a few years, that he can then retire? So we said yes. So they had a meeting, which I wasn't involved in. My involvement was that they asked me that. They had a meeting and just said to Derek, look, Derek, we are concerned about your health because this is just too much. It's just, it's a huge task and it's making you ill. So, you know, we're proposing that next year we get Russ and Guy and Russ to help you. Then the year after, and you, we, you know, each year we take a little bit off you so that by the end, in a few years, you can just enjoy the convention. And he just hit the roof. That was it. He just hit the roof, couldn't believe it, said, you don't want me. And we were like, it's not that we don't want you. It's that we want to help because it's not good. And that were it. And we never really heard from Derek again, which is a shame because I like Derek. You know, a lot of people didn't get on with Derek. I always get on with Derek. I was always...
He was very Marmite.
He was very Marmite. But I always got on with Derek. And I always liked Derek, to be honest. And I'd still, if he picked up the phone at me now, I'd still be quite happy to hear from him.
You knew where you stood with him. He was
one of those
people, you know, if he didn't like you, he made it absolutely crystal clear that he didn't like you.
No, he didn't mess about. He just told him. I always remember, I won't tell you who it is, but there was one of the kids entertainers who, when Derek run it and the champs weren't quite what they are now and everyone accused it of being rigged and things like that, which it wasn't, but... one of the kids entertainers, he entered and then he went to Derek afterwards. He went, when's the result? And Derek went, tomorrow night. And he said, well, I'm not happy about that. I want to know now if I've won, because if I've not won, I'm going home. And he said, well, we don't reveal the result until tomorrow night. We never have and we never will. And he went, well, unless you tell me the result, I'm not going. He said, because I'm not hanging around to find out if I've won. To which Derek's reply, while I was sitting there, was, well, I can tell you now, you've not won because you're shit. So go home. This person was furious. Went all over Facebook about it. And I thought, I can't really argue what happened because that is what happened.
Oh, my gosh. That's difficult. But one thing I've noticed is since you, Russ and Guy, have taken over, it's had a very different feel to it. And as you know, I stepped away from the whole of Magic for a few years. So I did my first Blackpool for many years in 2020. And previous to that, it was probably about 5 or 6 years since I'd been. It had a very different feel to it. Was that done on purpose?
Yeah, massively. We talked about when we took over, we had, literally, people don't realise. Number one, they think that me, Russ and Guy must make a fortune and all this. We don't. We're literally expenses. In fact, I'll be quite honest, it probably costs us money to...
Well, I'll say the same thing on record now that I said in the Russ Stevens interview, which is both you and Russ and Guy, I know you all. You are all so successful in your individual fields with what you do. You're so successful. You don't need to do Blackpool, even if you were making money off it, which I know you wouldn't. You don't need to do it because you're successful doing other stuff anyway, let alone the amount of stress and pressure you put on yourself.
So. It's the kick of it. It's the kick of it. I enjoy walking into that empty theatre on the Wednesday and there's nothing and building it to these huge shows, then back to nothing. I get a real kick out of that. And I get a real kick out of when we go into an event that we've put together and it works and it's good, you know, we really enjoy it. That's why we do it, really. It's just the love of it. And it's the love of just doing the magic stuff. You know, we've got a strong, all three of us have massive, strong interest. So we got together and we were like, what are the good bits about the convention and what are the bad bits? And we wrote a sheet. We agreed bad bits were the gala shows were too long. The gala shows were like a marathon. The gala shows had sometimes, in my opinion, acts that weren't up to scratch in the old days. I felt like there were problems with the Kids Entertainer Championships on how it was run and how it was judged. But we all agreed that the most exciting thing about Blackpool isn't the shows, isn't the dealers, it's the atmosphere, and it's the social aspect of it. So we wanted to, we decided that, I think it was Guy who came up with this analogy, that during the day was going to be play, was going to be work. So during the day was work. It's all lectures and it's all, you know, there's the odd bits of shows, but it's all work. You're learning stuff. Then from 6 o'clock, it's fun. It's play. That's it. And it were all aimed at, it was shows, it was big atmospheres, it was getting you drinking in those bars, getting you some fun. I introduced, I was very adamant, which Russ and Guy at first weren't, you know, as into as me. I was very adamant introducing the alternative late night events like the Not the Gala show, expanding on Beat the Wand, that Friday had to have something alternative. And we, you know, we just went with what we felt were the strong bits of the convention and built on it, and the weak bits of the convention, which is controversial, you know. We don't make a big deal of presenting awards anymore because I felt like we used to sometimes have a gala show that was really racing along, and then we'd have this awards section with the president giving someone an award, and it just dragged it all down, and we had to have a really good act to pull it back up again straight afterwards. So that was very that caused a lot of arguments with... It was me and Russ and Guy were like, we want to drop the awards, and the club were like, what? You can't do that. And it's like, you know, we've got to keep it modern, and that's that, really.
What do you think makes Blackpool as big as it is? Going back to Steve Evans, I remember many, many years ago paying for a ticket to go and watch him perform for a bunch of lay people, and he had a few other acts on, and he was emceeing it. And I remember him talking about the Blackpool Magic Convention. I remember him saying it was like in January time. He says, "Yeah, I'm excited because it's Blackpool next month. If you don't know what Blackpool is, it's a magic convention for magicians. How the world's largest magic convention ended up being in Blackpool on a seaside resort in the middle of February. I have no idea." And I remember laughing my ass off at that. But it's true. You know, Blackpool's freezing cold that time of the year. It's not the sort of place that you would think would host the World Championships, for example.
I think it built up. Bill Lamb, Tom Owen, Harry Dewhurst. You know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants there. And Derek. Remember, Derek completely changed that convention. He was the one who made it into a three-day event and changed a lot. Derek did a lot of good stuff for the club and for the convention. It's built up over the years, but if you want my personal opinion as to the big secret of Blackpool, that is the timing. The timing is impeccable. And it's always been at that last weekend of February. And at that weekend, it's a dead weekend for work, so most magicians aren't working, but it's also a good weekend because about that time, about 3 weeks before, all your money from Christmas has started to come in. Mm-hmm. So they've got some money, they've got no work on, and you've got all that money coming in, and you've done all that Christmas work, and you feel like, yeah, I've earned this. I earned this little bit of a break to go to Blackpool and have a good time. And I think as well now, the big thing for me, Russ and Guy, is the quality. It's got to be, you know, we've had some acts that are great acts, but we've looked at it and gone, is it going to work? Is it going to pull it down just that little bit? And, you know, we've really tried to pitch for a lot higher standard than ever, which is hard.
It is hard. You've definitely succeeded. Just last year, just in the last one you did in 2020, you had Yuri Geller, for God's sake.
That was insane, wasn't it? Yeah. And Yuri's become quite a good friend. Me and Yuri, you know, text each other once a week and chat. And that was quite an amazing thing because we tried to get hold of Yuri and we weren't getting any response. And Leo Manner, the mentalist guy, I was chatting to Leo about something else on WhatsApp. And I said something about Yuri, and he said, I've got Yuri's number. And he said, we don't really get on that great. He said, you know, you can tell him that I've said to call. So he gave me his number, his direct mobile. And I was like, to Russ and Guy, what do? I said, I can't just phone Yuri Geller, can I? So they're like, let's compose a decent text. So compose a decent text. And then about 2 days later, I went to the cinema. And I was sat in the cinema. And I looked out. I felt my watch going. Looked down. Uri Geller calling. So I thought, I've got to go out and answer that. This is crazy. So I went out and he said, so what do you want? So I said, my actual words were, I said, Yuri, I want you to stand in front of 3,500 people who know how you bend a spoon and tell them that's not how you do it. And I said, that's what I want. And he said, well, he said, how truthful or controversial do you want me to be? And I said, oh, I want you to go for it. And he said, I've only done one other convention and that was online and da, da, da. And he said, and, you know, I don't have a question and answer. I went, you've got to have a question and answer. I said, that's the other stipulation. I want a question and answer. And we had a lot of back and forth and, you know, and Yuri literally was, you really, this is really stepping into the lion's den for me. Like, you know, it's, and he said, it is going to be very controversial if you release that I'm appearing. So we eventually chatted a lot and then I talked him into it and he said, yes. And it was brilliant. It did what I wanted it to do. I've got a lot of friends who really are very annoyed that I booked Yuri because they know it was me who did it. And they're very annoyed at me about it. But it did what I wanted it to do. And that was, I wanted to release that Yuri Geller were going and I wanted everyone to go, what on earth? He's not a magician. What are you thinking? He's a fraud. He's this, he's that. And then other people saying he's the best magician ever because, you know, he's kept the secret. And I wanted that argument to happen and that controversy to happen.
And it did.
And it did. And it did. And I can tell you now, 3,500 people, a lot of them were sat in there, and I know it because they told me to see him fail, to have a go at him, and he pretty much won them all round. He really did. He was great. And I'll tell you one thing. I sat and had a coffee with him, and he said, can you do a spoon bend? So I said, yeah, of course I can. Do it. I went, no. I said, no way. And he went, just do one. And I went, no. And he said, go get a fork. And I said, I'm not doing a fork bend for Yuri Geller. I said, no chance. And he went, please, just do it. So I did it. And he sat there going, oh, my God, how did you do that? That's amazing. And I went, come on. I said, don't do that. Oh, don't do that to me. And he went, I don't know how you did it. He said, you don't do it like me. He said, I don't know how you did it. So anyway, we had a laugh about it and that was that. And he even brought it up in his lecture that he watched me do it and he didn't know I did it. And he said, tell my little girl, Florence, he said, tell Florence to bring a spoon from home. So she got this big, heavy spoon. I mean, really heavy. I mean, I couldn't bend it with a vice. It was really heavy. So she gave it him. And he said, oh, okay, watch. And I just thought, I am going to burn his hands. I am going to burn his hands so bad and see when he does it. And as God is my witness, I have no idea how he did it. I have no, he doesn't do it the same as me, no matter what. I have no idea. I burnt his hands and I swear he just put it and it just bent. And I'm like, I don't know how you've done that. And afterwards I said, I don't know. And he was like, well, I don't do it like you. That's all I'm saying. He's brilliant. Brilliant.
Incredible. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously at the end of 2020, you announced Chris Angel, which was massive. Everybody was in shock. Everybody was like, oh my gosh, how the hell have Blackpool got Angel? And then obviously we hit the pandemic.
Yeah. And it's sad because with Chris, we had so much planned. I mean, it really annoys me that you've got, and it's always the same people online that moan about everything at the convention. They moan about, you know, I always got amused about people going, oh, there's a queue. There didn't used to be a queue. And it's like, yes, because 5 years ago, 1,500 people turn up and now it's 5,000 people. So, of course, there's a queue now because the volume's like tripled. So that's why, you know, things like that annoy me when they're getting what they're getting and they have to wait.
I have a feeling, very quickly diverting, I have a feeling that your job with Blackpool is a thankless job.
Oh, like, yeah, very much.
You could get everything right and people will just expect.
Yeah, and so people will still pick something. That's what they do. So, he's, you know, that winds me up. What was I saying about before the queue?
Chris Angel.
Oh, Chris Angel, yes. So we had a lot of people saying, oh, Chris Angel's not going to perform. He's only appearing virtually. He's only appearing through a webcam and all this, which wasn't true. Chris was coming over. He wasn't going to, you know, people were like, why isn't he doing his show? And it's like, have you seen his show in Vegas? Do you really think that we could bring that over for one night? Even just one of the illusions would be impossible. So literally getting the stuff over and doing it would have been pretty impossible because he had to take the time out of the show, come and do it. It would have cost us millions because he physically would have had to shut down the show for 2 weeks while we got the props over and back and everything else. But he was going to come over. He was doing a big Q&A and mega talk like Yuri did in person live. We had about three other big things planned with him, which we were going to release. And then the pandemic hit. I mean, a week before they did lockdown, the first lockdown, me, Russ and Guy were going to Vegas to just spend the week with Chris to literally plan out and discuss everything we were going to do. He just emailed us and said, I don't want to Zoom anymore. I want to hang with you guys for a week and we work out how brilliant we can make this. And he had some really cool ideas what we were going to do. So that's that. So, you know, a lot of people are saying, is Chris coming in, you know, 2022? And the thing is, at the moment, because of the pandemic, we don't know with Chris. We are still talking to him and we are still trying to work out how, you know, it depends if his show's opened again. If his show's opened again, then we've got less of a chance of him being able to take the time off the show to come over. But as soon as we know, then we let people know.
Well, before we talk about the virtual convention, Blackpool, as far as you're aware, from a planning point of view, will be coming back as a live event in 2022. Is that?
Yeah, we're gonna plan it as a live event. Funnily enough, me and Russ were just talking about it today. Me, Russ and Guy talk every day about the convention, every day. And we were discussing it and saying, you know, how we're going to plan it. And I've said, you know, we have to have contingencies in place in case we can't go ahead again. We have to have contingencies in case they suddenly say you can't have that many people in the building. So then we have to make it a smaller event. The Winter Gardens will have all the new section. I mean, this is what happened last year. Last year, we did have an overcrowding problem. We had that because the Winter Gardens should have had a full new section opened, in which case it wouldn't have been any problems. We'd have put Matt King where we needed Matt King and everything else, but it wasn't open, which sort of buggered us up a bit. So the Winter Gardens will have more space, which will give us the place to social distance and everything else if we have to. So, but we are planning it to go ahead. We're, you know, working with who can definitely do it and who can commit, and the ones that can't commit yet, then we're gonna have them sort of so that we can slot them in if it does work. But hopefully, I mean, we are still talking with Chris. Only yesterday we were chatting to him about things. So we are hopefully going to work with Chris for 2022 as well.
Do you ever find, like, every year since you Guy and Russ took over, the quality you've one-upped yourself every single year. You've set a precedent now. Do you find yourselves under pressure?
Yeah, massively.
So good that you have to really deliver?
I don't really know how we can top Lance and Arturo and Marco and Yuri from last year. I mean, that was a hell of a thing. Lance was, you know, it's Lance Burton in the end. And he was the nicest guy you could ever meet, Lance. Really, really. And it was a little bit, without going into it, we have arranged for some of the bigger names, like a secret bar hidden somewhere. We don't tell anybody where it is. And there's only like 20 or 30 people going there because we found that some of the big names, if they went to try and have a drink at the Ruskin or even West Coast or wherever, they just got mobbed. You know, they just didn't stand a chance. So we used to have that. And I can remember there was so many times last convention that I sat there drinking. And then at one point, I thought, my God, I'm sat drinking with you, Lance Burton. This is insane. And one of our lasting memories was Lance's team, Arturo, Fielding West, who's the best person to drink with in the world. It's brilliant. Lance. And I can't remember how, but at some point at 3 a.m, all of us were dancing round, jumping up and down, singing To Life from Fiddler on the Roof at the top of our voice. I don't know how that happened. It just like spontaneously happened. Really. It was great.
That is incredible. That is awesome. That is brilliant. So it now brings us on to the virtual convention, which is happening on the 18th of April.
Mm-hmm.
Questions. One, it's taking place live at the Winter Garden.
Yeah.
Which is so nice. You know, it would be very easy for you just to reach out to a few magicians and say, hey, put your webcam on and just give us 15 minutes or pre-recorded video. And you're doing it for free. And you could charge for something like this. You absolutely could, because you're going to have costs. You know, these people aren't going to be coming to the Winter Gardens for free. You're going to have costs, but you've made the decision to put this out for free.
Yeah.
And ever since the trailer dropped with Izzy on it, which was just a wonderful, wonderful video, people are buzzing about this. Like, so why did you do it for free? Like, what was the reason?
We had a discussion about, first of all, we discussed whether we do a virtual or not. And we all felt that something should be done. So we watched a lot of online virtual events, a lot. And we, again, what we did when we took over the convention, we sat down, me, Russ and Guy, and we worked out what was good, what we thought was good and what we thought was bad. And we all agreed that we didn't like the, we're going to go on a webcam to somebody's house. And we wanted it to feel a bit more special than that. Like a TV program that if you didn't see it then live, you missed it. That was it. You know, once it's shown, we're probably going to take it down. We're not going to leave it on Facebook. We're probably going to take it down. So you see it or you miss it, and that's it. So we all had the same idea on that. And then we discussed different things of how we could make it work. And then without Russ, Guy, all the club's permission, without anybody's permission, I went to the Winter Gardens and met the general manager. And I said, what would be the deal if we did this from a lockdown Winter Gardens? Said, so it's, there's nobody in here but us. And we locked it down and we did stuff on the stage. We did stuff in the ballroom and it was completely empty. I said, because I think it'd have a huge impact, because people normally see that buzzing. They don't see that building empty like we do. And they, you know, it's quite an impactful thing to see it in that condition. So I had a few back and forth with him, and brilliantly, they've worked with us on it and just said, you know, we want to work with you on it. And, you know, we want to, you know, we'll literally give you it at cost. So it's just at cost. So they did a brilliant job. And then we then decided we had to get people in. So we had a look who we thought were good magicians in England. So we compiled a list, which are the list of people that are doing it. Pretty much everyone agreed that we asked to do it. Or everybody's doing it for costs. It's still costing us quite a lot of money, even just at costs. And then we decided that we just wanted to make it a free event that everybody can attend and give something a little bit back. We're probably going to have a donate button. My dad died of pulmonary hypertension, so we might have a donate button for an animal charity, because me, Russ and Guy are both very much into our animals, and also to, you know, the charity for my dad as well. And that's that, and see if we can raise a few pound as well while we do it. But we just wanted it to be good. Again, that's the thing. And it's posed a lot of challenges. Last week, Russ was working down on a TV show, front and deck, and Guy's been doing stuff and I've been doing stuff. And last week we did a dry run. We did a dry run where I went into the Winter Gardens with a special guest, which was Tony Stevens, and I dried run doing everything, whereas Russ and Guy dried run the whole Facebook Live thing of commenting and working with it. And, you know, and we've had to spend a lot of time learning stuff for it. But I think it'll be a great event, to be honest. I think it'll be quite unique.
Oh, I think it will. Absolutely, 100%. And it sounds awesome. So where can people go to see it? Is it literally...
It's going to be... One sec. I'm just seeing, because I've just got that. My battery's going. I may have to go get my charger. it's going to be on Facebook Live only. So you got the Blackpool Conventioneers page on Facebook Live. Add yourself. But when you add yourself, there's three questions about magic to answer. And if you don't answer those questions, we don't let you in the group, because we have a lot of spam. So The very simple questions, literally name a magician. You know, you could Google the answers. So add yourself on there and it'll be on Facebook Live at 6 p.m. on the 18th. It's quite a mammoth task. You know, we are going to be cutting, rather than just do it from one room, the ballroom will be the hub of everything. But we are going to be cutting to cameras up into the Opera House, which will feel very strange for people to see backstage and a bare stage, because the auditorium's being renovated, so that's all shut off. So it will be a bare stage with the iron in the safety curtain. We'll cut up to the Spanish Hall with Mark Oberon. We've got things going on in the pavilion. We've got things going on in the ballroom where the dealers are, which when you see the ballroom with no dealers in empty, that'll freak you all out. It looks so weird. In the atrium, we've got Brendan Rodriguez doing his stuff. So it's quite a big task. We are going to, although it's only on live that day, it's going to be 3 days work of going in with the axe and prepping it and making sure everything's going to work.
You guys just don't do things by half, do you?
We try not to do.
That's amazing. And how long is it going to run for? So from 6 o'clock in the evening?
It's 7 to 4 hours. we're going to try and aim for it to be about 5 hours maximum, because I just think some of these, when you're trying to do it for a full day and stuff, you know, no matter how good it is, you're going to lose interest. But we also as well are trying to make each segment only last about 20 minutes.
Cool.
That's so awesome.
And it's not going to stay on Facebook forever, so people
no watch it live, because chances are we're going to discuss this again tonight. Chances are we're just going to take it down when it's finished. We want it to be, you see it, you experience it, and then that's it, it's gone.
Perfect. That's absolutely brilliant. Now, before we wrap this whole interview up, I want to bring it back to you, Russ, and ask you one last question. It's been a fantastic interview. It really has. And you're a wealth of knowledge. My question is, what's next? And that's a question I ask every single person I interview. But I mean, let's be honest, you've done so much. You know, you've worked all over the world. You supply acts all over the world. You've done so much. If you quit today and decided, you know what, I'm just going to get a normal job, which I know you wouldn't do, your legacy is set. But I know that you're not going to slow down. Is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you haven't done?
The only thing that I've got left on my magical bucket list, which I'm actually talking about at the moment, is I've always wanted my own venue. As in, you know, I've always been given the Tower or the Horseshoe Bar, and Amanda's offered me, you know, the Globe for the summer season, which I've had to say no, just in case the ships come off, because that'll take up all my time. I've always wanted my own venue, and I've always had the idea for, and I'm trying to think who's done it, like the Small Space in Wales, where it's a very intimate magic venue. The first time I saw it that I thought, oh, I'd love something like this, was Steve Cohen's show in New York, and Rodney's original House of Illusion. That I just went in and I thought, oh, this is great. I'd love my own venue. And that's something I'm in talks with at the moment. Literally a venue right outside the Winter Gardens as well. So a perfect location for it. But it's a big leap. Especially how the world is at the moment, that I get 40 people in into this tiny venue and do a show. But that's one thing I've always thought I've never done and I'd like to do. So that is a maybe. That's a watch this space. I am in very heavy talks about doing that at the moment.
Wow, that would be absolutely incredible. And are we, as far back as I can remember, I mean, I've talked about how brilliant I think your lecture is, and I do think it's an amazing lecture. Where are you ever going to book yourself to lecture at the convention?
One sec. Let me go get the charger, because I've got 3%.
Okay. I'll be one sec. No problem.
There we go. I just don't want it to run out halfway through. There we go. That's better.
Awesome. I'll take it from
from the booking at the convention.
Yeah, we're almost done anyway. We're a couple of minutes left in the end. So, you know, I talked earlier on about how amazing your lecture is and how much I love it. Why have you never booked yourself to lecture at the convention?
I've done the convention twice. In fact, my first ever lecture was Blackpool. My first ever lecture. Throwing you in, isn't it?
Well, that's not stressful at all, is it?
So I've done Blackpool twice and a few others like Tricks in the Sticks and stuff like that, which is a great convention. They're doing a virtual as well. So it's worth buying a ticket for that because they've got some great names. I don't think now, with everything else, I could handle the stress of lecturing or performing as well, on top of everything else. Because it's in the weeks up to it, I mean, I'd say 6 weeks running up to the convention, it drives my wife insane, the amount of time it takes. And I just don't think I could possibly take the lecture on as well, on top of everything else. Because like I said, the stress is, it's unreal. It's unreal. And that's what I said about it amuses me that people say, oh, you know, when they moan about things on Facebook, about tiny little things at the convention. And, you know, I can remember last year there was somebody that I won't say who it was that I knew. And, oh, my God, he just on Facebook, he'd really slated everything. And I just saw him walking around and he went, oh, hi, Russ. Oh, this is great. And I went, well, not what you said on Facebook, is it? And he was like, oh, you know, it's just a few teething things. And I said, listen, I said, come with me. And I walked him to the front doors and I went, I'm going to give you your money back. I said, because you think it's so bad, because you hate it so much, I will give you your money back, but you've got to leave. No, no, no. And then he took it all down straight away.
Oh, my God. That's one way.
Funny enough, it's a funny thing because people say, oh, don't, you know, it's just, don't take it personal, all this. But we put so much of our heart and soul into it that you can't not.
Yeah. You know, people that moan, I'd love to see them walk a mile in your shoes. I'd love to see them go backstage and try to organise even one small part of the convention, let alone the whole bloody thing.
I know. I can remember arguing with somebody in the club once who said to me, you know, why do you get to work with these people? And I'm like, okay. And I said, so Lance Burton's walked up to you and he's talking about the backdrop and he's saying, I'm doing thread lighting and is it a silver slash that we've got on the backdrop? And how big are the flies? And once you've got the flies, what's the apron on the stage? And you know it's got a rake. And he went, huh? And I went, this is it, you see. I said, this is what you... I said, this is how people talk to you. I said, and unless you have done it and know your onions a bit, I said, then you quickly end up in a mess, really. So it's a funny thing. When we first took over, Russ said, you know, we are going to get as much hassle as we're going to get praise. He was spot on.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's a thankless job, but, you know, what you guys do on behalf of the Magic community, thank you, because I know how much time and effort you guys put into organising this, and it is a thankless job. So thank you so much. Honestly, thank you. One other question. If there's somebody watching this that's wanting to make a name for themselves in Magic, maybe they've released a product, maybe they've released a couple of products, they've started lecturing, and their goal, because I know a lot of people that become creators, their goal is to appear in some way at Blackpool, whether it be a lecturer or even performing in the bear pit or performing on stage, whatever it may be. How would that person get onto your radar?
They could contact either me, Russ, or Guy and tell us a bit about themselves, send some videos and stuff like that. To be honest, we don't get many people who contact us. We do get them, but a lot of the ones that contact us, we look at him, we go, that's not going to work or that's not quite right. Whereas we usually find stuff ourselves. We spend hours and hours watching YouTube, watching, you know, one of our things that we really like to do is find the underground stuff and find the stuff that, you know, that is very, very different. Like, you know, I spent a long time trying to sort out the magic in the dark thing last year, because I just loved the concept that somebody did a magic show where they shut off one of your senses and it was all in pitch black. And that was, you know, when I found that show existed, it was Max Maven who told me about the show. Russ and Guy were like, that's brilliant. That's such a cool idea. And again, that was so much work. There were so many calls of, you know, at first he was saying, I don't know if it'll work for magicians, and back and forth. And that's what we like to do as well. We like to find something that's an up and coming, or something that's been running that magicians don't really know about. So quite often, if you are good, we will probably find you anyway.
Don't call us, we'll call you.
Yeah, but you can call us.
A little bit like the A-team.
Yeah, you can call us, but it usually is that we find stuff and go, oh, yeah, that's good, that'd work. And, you know.
It goes back to the advice we talked about earlier on from Steve Evans, be so good that you guys can't ignore them.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's the best advice.
Yeah, that's amazing. Russ, this has been an incredible interview. Thank you so much. You've had such a varied career. You've had so much that's going on. There's been a lot of advice that you've given. Thank you so much for coming on the interview. Like I said,
thanks for asking me. It's been fun, actually. I've enjoyed it.
You've been phenomenal. Where can people contact you? I mean, is there, you know, if they want to reach out to you, I just want to put it at the bottom of the screen.
The best thing is to just email me, which is russ@russbrownmagic.com. So just drop me an email and say hello.
Brilliant stuff. Russ, thank you very much. I'll be tuning in on the 18th. I know a lot of people around the world will be tuning in.
Forget to give us some comments, because we've already decided.
Yeah. Literally.
Comments. One of the things when we said we looked at things that were good and what were bad, and one thing that we noticed is a lot of live stream events, not just magic, there'll be comments on Facebook and they only pick out the good ones, which we're not going to do. You know, if there's bad ones in there, we're going to reference them. So don't forget to comment and have some fun with us. Because I think that's what Blackpool is. It's fun. But I've always said it's Blackpool is magic's biggest party. So, my dog's come to say hello. My little puppy.
Oh, what's his name?
She's called Nell. She's an idiot. She's only 6 months old and she's already caused us so many problems.
Haven't you? She's adorable. That's amazing. And what a fantastic way to end the interview.
Production, dog production.
Absolutely. Hey, I remember competing. I'll tell you right now, I remember competing at Blackpool. I competed in the close-up 3 times. And I remember the second time competing. And it was when John Vanderput was performing. And it was before Piff.
Yeah.
And I went out there and I was like, I think I did pretty good. I'm really confident. And I then stood at the side to watch John go out and do his thing. And he made a dog appear in his act. And I'm like, how am I going to beat making
a dog appear? You're not going to tell that.
I'm like, in the middle of a close-up competition, you've just made a dog appear. That's it. I'm done.
Yeah. It's definitely a finish. Definitely.
It really is. It was amazing. It was amazing. So many wonderful memories from Blackpool. What... I'm going to sign this interview off now, Russ, but before I do, what's your favourite memory from Blackpool? Oh. From all the years that you've done it, your one memory that stands out?
That's a difficult one, really.
I know you've got so many.
I've got a lot. Last year was brilliant with Lance and Yuri. We were brilliant. Memory-wise, some of the memories are Blackstone, meeting Blackstone as a child and seeing the floating light bulb. That was like, you know, that was very, very cool. And of working it, let me have a think. Working it wise, it was very, Yu Ho Jin, when he first did his act, that was like a real atmosphere backstage. And the other one that I will always be a good memory and always fun was Hans Moretti. Whenever I worked with Hans, he was always great to work with. And I'll tell you a very quick story. That's a really good memory. It's really funny. Greg Fruin, when Greg Fruin won FISM and he first ever come to Blackpool, he turned up, we're doing his dove act. This is a good story to finish on, actually. He did his dove act. And Greg, afterwards, we went to the Ruskin, and he didn't know anybody there because there were no real, you know, there were nobody from Canada or America. You know, he had a few friends there, but that's it. So I got drinking with him, and so did Paul Zennon, Tony Stevens, and I think there were a couple more there, but I can remember it, me, Tony, and Greg, yeah, and Paul, all sat drinking. And it got to 4 in the morning, and the bar manager came up, and he went, right, it's closing. We were shutting the bar. So Greg was like, no, I'm a resident at the hotel. And they went, yeah, but the bar's closing. He said, you know, everyone were going. And he went, well, just, can you bring me some beer, and we'll just sit here? And they went, yeah. They said, what have you got? What bottles? So he come back, and he went, there's Budweiser. And, he went, no, how many? He come back with a trolley, and he said, bring me every bottle you've got in the bar. So he come back with his trolley loaded with bottles, and we carried on drinking, to the point that at 9 in the morning the hotel manager come up to us and went, lads, you're gonna have to stop now because people are coming down for the breakfast, and this is really embarrassing, this is very, very bad. So we were like, right, okay. So that was that. And then I think I went home and I slept for like 2 days. I can remember getting in, and my wife like, where have you been? Drinking. So that was that. So it was a really fun time. It was really funny. I can't remember what we all ended up chatting about and doing. But the reason I'm telling you this story is 6 months later, we sat at the club at the AirGem. And as I said, the convention, there's a reason the convention's like it is, and that is most of the money that we get from the convention, we spend. You the money that you're putting in, you're seeing it on the stage and everything, because we're spending it. We spend nearly all of it to make it amazing. And the treasurer at the time, Steve Easton, stood up and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to bring to the attention of the entire committee that this year's top of the bill, Greg Frewin, left the Ruskin Hotel without paying a very, very, very substantial bar bill. And then he went, and I believe a member of this club encouraged him to do so, and that member should stand up now and apologise. And I was sat on the back like this, and the entire club's looking at me. And then when Greg come back about, God, it must have been 10 years later, we brought Greg back for FISM. I told him the story, and I went, I said, I've got a funny story to tell you about last time you were here. So I told him, and he went, oh, I'm going to do it again. So he did. That's one of my good memories. That was a really fun memory. So,
whoa, that is insane. That is insane. I've got to ask you, what was it like when you had that act on the gala show where there were just a million Bird productions? What was it
Old
like?
Paul Derrick, the most requested act to get back on the convention. And people often say, why don't you rebook Paul Derrick? The reason is that'll never happen again. That was a one-off situation. That was one-off. I'll tell you a few stories about this. Paul Derrick turned up to his tech call. He had all his birds with him. Like, literally, there were birds shit everywhere. And I said to him, right, I said, what do you need? And he went, oh, just get lights on. Turn him on. And I went, well, no special lighting. No, turn him on. What about your music? Play this. And he gave us some organ music. So we had to go get an organist. And I went, right, okay. Is that it? Oh, I'll just play that. That'll do. So I said, right, okay. So Juan, who works backstage, I then went, is that it, Paul? I said, what about setting props? I'll do it myself. I said, is that it? All right. So then Juan, who works backstage, who has done for a long time, is the guy with the long hair that you'll see on stage a lot, who speaks like Ali G. Juan then went, has he got your birds with you, man? So Paul Derrick went, aye, they're over there. And he went, has he got a cockerel? And he went, aye. And he went, would you get your cock out and put it on my hand? And so without a hint of irony, Paul Derrick went, I'll go get him. So he went, got the cockerel. And he was the best tech call we have ever had, because for 20 minutes, we just also getting pictures with owls and birds and stuff. So he says stuff. I was stood with John Archer in the wings. And we have got footage of this, which we've never shown. But if you watch the footage back, the audience are starting to turn on him because he's gone on a long time and they're starting to turn on him. They're starting to get a bit restless. And yeah, they were going to turn it felt like they were going to turn nasty. And one thing happened at the same time, and that was that this duck kept running off and we kept chucking it back on, which was getting a laugh. So it was me and Wan were picking it up and chucking it back on. At one point, I picked it up and run around and chucked it on the other side. And at the same point as that, he was doing some supreme trick, which wasn't great. But at that exact point, the organist started playing the tune to Indiana Jones. And it just felt like, da, 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 da. That's this box. And the audience changed. You felt this absolute warmth. You could feel it on the stage. And I tell you now, when you're backstage there, if the audience are turning on them, the atmosphere drops like unbelievably. But when it works, you feel the warmth. You feel like the love coming from the audience. And that happened in waves at this point, in waves. You just felt this like love of this guy carrying on doing this. Straight away, and it turned, and then everybody loved him. And I remember the thing that got me and John was, John thought it was the end. And he went, ladies and gentlemen, Paul Derrick. And as he did that, I went, no, no, no. And he went, what? And I went, there's another four ducks. And then me and John, if you see the footage, me and John couldn't even look at each other. And I went on to sweep the stage after him. And every time John spoke, if we looked at each other, we both just burst out laughing. He was brilliant. He's our most requested act to bring back is Paul Derrick.
But it could have gone very differently.
It could have gone very differently. You know, we'd had incidents the year before with a couple of acts and like the George King incident, which was can you imagine our stage managing and making the call on that? I was the one who got him off stage and went, go home. It was... You know, you imagine that backstage, the atmosphere was horrific. So we'd had a few incidents, which it could have gone the other way, but it didn't. It went completely the other spectrum.
It was the most talked about. Is that why you wouldn't bring him back? Because
I don't think it would be repeated. I personally think it was a one-off, and Russ agrees, Guy agrees, it was a one-off situation. It was a one-off. And if you come back again, it wouldn't work the same. It wouldn't work the same. It was like a roller coaster of emotions, that act that ended up with everybody on the feet absolutely loving this guy. And I think it was a one-off, and I wouldn't want it to repeat it, and it didn't work the same.
And is there footage of it anywhere?
There is footage. Whether we'll show it or not is another matter. We'll have to wait and see.
Fair enough. Ross, what an amazing way to end the whole interview. You are, and I've said this on record before on the channel, I'll say it again, you're one of the nicest guys in magic. You're very hardworking. What you do behind the scenes, you deserve a medal for. And if anybody has ever been to Blackpool and they've had a good time, a big reason for that is because how tirelessly you work backstage, making sure that everything is run smoothly so that people can enjoy it. So on behalf of the magic community and every single person that's ever come to Blackpool, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me. It's been great fun. Loved it.
No problem, my friend. Leave a comment down below. And if Russ sees it, I'm sure he'll answer. And guys, don't forget to subscribe to the channel. I'll be back again tomorrow with another video. So we'll see you again. Thanks very much. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic, magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel. Magic TV. Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV. Or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.